WNYC is supported by Air France, presenting the A380, whose first-class section has a private dressing area complete with table, locker, and more. Air France is the official carrier for Marseille-Provence 2013, European Capital of Culture. More at airfrance.us.
You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Are people who live in cities happier? Well, Charles Montgomery spent 5 years investigating the intersection of urban design and the so-called science of happiness, and he reveals that where and how we live can have profound effects on our sense of well-being. His findings are in his latest book, Happy City, Transforming Our Lives Through Urban Design. It's published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux, and I'm very pleased that it's brought Charles Montgomery to our show today. Hello.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Hasn't there always been a sense that people are unhappy in cities?
I suppose there has. And in fact, that sense that cities make us unhappy or are unhealthy or dangerous has caused much of the rapid and ongoing sprawl in American cities, people's attempts to escape cities.
Now, is that something that is part of our history? I know Thomas Jefferson really did not like cities, but I suspect that people were arguing against cities going all the way back to the Middle Ages, or maybe even Rome.
Well, you could suggest that, and it has been true. Of course, the Roman elite had their villas in the countryside, but if you go back a little further, let's say to the classical age of ancient Greece, in Athens, they believed very deeply in the project of the city, and in fact, the most important place in the city was the agora, right at the heart of the city, where commerce, ideas, spirituality, and a chaotic mixing of people happened.
The so-called mayor of Happy, Enrique Peñalosa of Bogota, Colombia, is one of the key figures influencing changes in cities around the world. What's his story?
Well, this guy, he's somewhat of an evangelist for the notion that urban design can really influence well-being in cities. In fact, he used his own city, Bogota, Colombia, as a laboratory for happiness.
Hasn't Bogota been plagued with problems?
It certainly was, and it is again. But there was a time at the end of the 20th century where Bogota was considered to be one of the worst places in the world to live. And he had a 3-year term. And what he said to his citizens was, look, I'm not going to make you richer. We're never going to catch up to the gringos. But maybe if we have a different goal, we can achieve it. Why shouldn't our goal for success be happiness?
So that happiness wasn't just a side effect of improvements that he made? It was actually the goal?
This was the intention.
How do you do that?
Well, we can't say
put alcohol in the water?
We can't say that his... No, with urban design. So we can't say his approach was driven by empirical evidence. But the intent was to make it more happy. And what he did was he essentially redesigned his city and he changed his city systems to boost feelings of happiness. What that meant in Bogota, a place where there was tremendous poverty, where only 20% of the people actually owned cars, was to take that common resource, the streets, and share it with more people. What that meant was declaring war on cars and building a network of rapid buses so that poor people could travel as quickly across the city as rich people. It meant building bike lanes. It meant instead of investing $6 billion in urban freeways, they invested in schools, daycares, parks, libraries.
And how did the residents react? Did people resist his ideas?
They tried to impeach him. It didn't work out. So you had this situation in Bogota where the elite had... And their motor vehicles dominated the city. They parked on sidewalks. They turned plazas into parking lots. So Peñalosa's first order of business was to get those cars off the sidewalks and give them back to people. The business lobby said he was trying to satanize the car. They tried to impeach him. They failed. Eventually, his program seemed to work. By the end of his term, not only were people murdering each other less, not only were streets safer, not only was the air cleaner, but that people had moved from a place of depression and sadness to a place of optimism about the future.
Well, for almost a century, the automobile has been the main factor in urban and suburban development. It's influenced the way cities have been laid out. You point out that automobile accidents are the leading cause of death for people under 35, at least in the rest of the world. In the United States, I think gun deaths are the number one cause, but auto accidents number two. But that isn't just in the cities, is it?
Well, it depends what you call a city. So here in the United States, and this is something that New Yorkers don't always understand, is the city, a city, an American city, usually looks almost nothing like Manhattan. An American city is a place of what you might call sprawl, of functional segregation of uses, where you have your shopping center here, you have your living areas over there, and you have your parks over here, you have workplaces over there. Everything has been functionally segregated so that people will depend on their vehicles to get around. It started as a very logical response to the crowding of inner cities and the pollution that you sometimes found there.
And it led to the decline of the downtowns of many of the older cities.
It certainly did. But now you have a situation where Americans are so spread out across the landscape that their social lives and their very well-being has been jeopardized by this long-distance living.
So you mentioned that Bogota started bike lanes and things like that. Mm-hmm. He isn't the first mayor to do that sort of thing.
No, certainly not. No.
In fact, bikes were really important in China until recently. It's interesting that Chinese cities are moving in the opposite direction as they are developing. More and more people are moving to the outskirts where they're building new housing. And so they're buying cars where in the past they could get around on bicycles.
Well, there's a difference between the things we choose to do that we think will make us happy and the things that actually make us happy. This is what behavioral economics is teaching us now, is we're actually very bad at choosing happiness.
Well, we are still fighting over bikes in this city, even though there has been a strong push to have more people ride bikes. Part of the problem with bike riding is that people don't obey the laws. They don't ride in the bike lanes. They don't. They go across red lights. They ride on the sidewalk. So isn't part of happiness also getting people to live by the rules?
I would think it's very important to build a culture of trust and respect. And in fact,
how do you do that? You're in Vancouver, right?
Yeah.
I didn't see a lot of bikes in Vancouver.
That's changing. So what happens in a city is the city actually designs our behavior. If you have no bike lanes ever, there'll be very few cyclists because it's terrifying. Once you start to design this infrastructure, you begin to grow a culture and change the way people decide to move. Once you've built that culture, people adopt these new rules. I think education could be a very big part of this in New York City.
Another factor, of course, is pollution, burning fossil fuels, and the rising gas prices, things like that, that all make relying on cars less sustainable, make us a little unhappier. Is that becoming a factor in city planning?
It is, but I think it's often a mistake to dwell on those issues. The truth is, people are not going to change their behavior based on guilt or the idea that sustainability is a hair shirt you must wear. People will change their behavior when life is easier that way. This is what's happened in Copenhagen.
Well, one of the things that people say would really help is more public transportation. But in this country, hasn't there been resistance on the federal level to supporting public transportation?
It's a sad thing, but it's the inspiring part is that, as in so many other issues, cities are now leading the way.
Are people happier? Has anybody done a study when they can walk or bike to work?
Well, here's the issue. If you look at the Netherlands, where in fact cities have built infrastructure that supports all ways of moving, that supports a full range of choice, people surveyed on how they've enjoyed their commutes, cyclists and pedestrians claim to experience more joy, less fear, rage, and sorrow than all other users. Sadly, even in the Netherlands, people who use public transit still have the worst time of all.
Even when they're on those trolleys that are so charming?
Even when they're on those pretty trolleys. Something happens on transit. It may be that the status of using transit is less, but you have less control over your journey.
Well, people have often praised New York for being a pedestrian city. There are a few others in the United States, but as you point out, most of them have moved in the other direction.
It's true.
San Francisco, I think, is a walking city. Where else?
Yeah, it's true. There are pockets in every city, in fact, that are walkable and connected. I think one can't judge the happiness of any particular city based on any one metric. But what we do know is that when people live in more walkable, connected, mixed-use neighborhoods, they're more likely to know their neighbors. They're more likely to trust each other. And trust is the bedrock of social relationships in cities.
My guest is Charles Montgomery. His latest book is Happy City, Transforming Our Lives Through Urban Design. It's published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. We'll continue our conversation after this. We're back with Charles Montgomery. He's written a book called Happy City, Transforming Our Lives Through Urban Design, published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. This is unlike your previous book. So what got you into this?
Yeah, my last book was a journey through the South Pacific. I edited some of that book when I was living in Mexico City. And I realized that cities themselves have this magic and mystery to them that was even more fascinating than the land of myths I experienced in the South Pacific.
Well, I love Mexico City, but on Friday, the air has a color to it because of all the pollution, and you're kind of scared to take a deep breath.
Back to this question of design, that in fact is changing, even in Mexico City, as the city adopts more greener ways of using space and moving people.
Let's talk about this whole idea of happiness. Don't people tend to have very different ideas about what makes them happy and what happiness is? So can happiness be measured?
Well, it's true. Your happiness and my happiness may be very different. You might enjoy, you know, barbecuing steaks in the Walmart parking lot, and I may prefer, I don't know, sitting on my front porch. However,
we don't have Walmart in New York.
soon. Well, look, in the last couple of decades, after a couple of thousand years of our species trying to figure out what we mean by happiness and whether we can measure it, in fact, neuroscientists have found that if you ask someone how happy they are and then look at the activity in their brain, pop them in an MRI machine, you can actually chart the activity in the pleasure centers of their brain. Just as when people claim to be sad, they have more stress hormones in their bloodstream.
Well, you talk about stress because many people think of cities as being stressful, but there's good stress and there's bad stress.
Certainly, and I feel it this morning. You know, I have came down to WNYC from my place up in Midtown, and the journey itself was thrilling for me. Just as when I live in Mexico City, the time is thrilling. Of course, it's different for people who have to put up with those stresses every single day.
What is the so-called hedonic treadmill?
It's a concept from behavioral economics which suggests that that we all have this set point of happiness. But I think it's worth adding some nuance. So the idea is that you feel really happy on the day that you buy your new house or get a new car. And then after a few months, you get used to that special new thing and your happiness falls back to its set point. What this doesn't acknowledge is that there are some things we never get used to. The irritation of a frustrating commute that changes every day, or the wondrous kind of blessings that come in friendship, in good connections with other people. You just don't get used to those things. So if we're thinking about how to build happiness in cities, we need to do all we can to promote richer experiences and maybe value a little bit less some of these privatized comforts we've come to pursue.
Well, a lot of people talk about how the city is anonymous, but I live in a neighborhood where everybody talks to everybody on our street. Mm. It's kind of like being in suburbia at the same time being in the city. And I don't think that's all that unusual in many places. So why has city living been given this bad rap about you don't know any of the people you live near?
I can't say why it's been given a bad rap, but I can tell you what the evidence is suggesting. We know two things. If you live on the very edge of suburban sprawl and you live in a car-dependent community, the stats say you are less likely to know your neighbors, less likely to have dinner with your family, less likely to trust others, less likely to vote, less likely to volunteer. It goes on and on. However, at the other end of the spectrum, we hit another peak of mistrust, which is people living in towers. People who live in towers, sorry, Manhattan, but people living in towers are, again, less likely to trust their neighbors, help each other, and feel comfortable than people who live somewhere in the middle.
You propose a basic recipe for urban happiness. What does it include?
Well, taking evidence from neuroscience and psychology and also from experiences of urban activism from around the world, it includes feelings. So first I can talk about feelings, and then we can talk about interventions. We want to feel free in cities, free to choose various ways of living and moving. We want to feel safe. We want to feel healthy. And feeling healthy is much more important than actually being healthy. So when you complain about the air quality in Mexico City, you may also want to think about how beautiful the city looks in that color. But most of all, we need to live in cities where we have a lot of trust for other people in the city.
Well, we also have better medicine, better sanitation. There are
sure, these things
more
are
access to welfare programs. There mm-hmm. Is access to higher education.
Mm-hmm.
So, and those come with the cities themselves. When were urban design and architecture first linked with happiness? Was it in ancient Rome?
I would say, first of all, in ancient Greece.
They actually were writing about it?
You know, I would point this to actually the Enlightenment. So this is in the 18th century when there was enough money around and enough leisure time for policymakers to start saying, well, not only do people not only can we experience true happiness here on Earth, but policymakers have a responsibility to promote it. Jeremy Bentham, you know, the father of utilitarianism, suggested we should do everything we can to maximize pleasure and minimize pain. That was expressed in the public realm, say in the public gardens that started popping up in England and France around that time.
Can you explain the evolutionary happiness function determined by the Nobel Prize-winning economist Gary Becker and Luis Rayo of the University of Chicago?
Oh, this is a big downer for me. It's a very complicated equation, but what it represents, these guys tried to distill learnings from behavioral economics, psychology, and see how this fits with the with evolutionary psychology. And what they found was that, what we are all coming to know in our own lives, which is that we're never quite satisfied with anything because you're always comparing what you have today with what you had yesterday and with what you might have tomorrow. What it explains, sadly in my case, was my own desperate wish to have a bigger, more comfortable house, which I went and did, got a bigger mortgage like so many millions of Americans did, and then realized after that, oh darn, I became dissatisfied again only a few short months later, and yet I had this tremendous mortgage to take care of.
Well, I had a terrible commute today, but it was stressful at the time. It took twice as long as usual, but I assume tomorrow the bus is going to come on time and the trains will not be stopping between stations. So I guess as we get older, we realize that these are only temporary problems. The same thing is true if you live in the suburbs. If you're trying to come into town, the railroads sometimes don't work well, or the highways are clogged. So is it all that different living in the city or the suburbs in regard to the kinds of things we associate with city stress?
Well, there's a question of stress, first of all. I think this is a question for your policymakers to answer. We know that when you don't meet your train connections, or even if you're scared that you won't meet your train connections, your commute becomes so much more stressful. Psychologists have actually taken samples of salivary cortisol, stress hormones, from the mouths of commuters coming in from New Jersey to New York City, and they find that the fewer connections you need to make, the less stressful your journey. So those journeys should be made less stressful. And Penn Station, my God, this is at the epicenter of commute dissatisfaction in New York City.
On the other hand, New York has more parks than a lot of cities, and we're adding them. We have the High Line. I was in Seattle recently, and there's a sculpture park that was obviously inspired by the High Line. Cities are imitating New York now.
Some cities are. Every city seems to want a High Line now. I think the High Line is important to mention because studies on the effect of nature in cities tell us that we need nature, to feel more calm and to think more clearly, but that access to nature actually changes our attitudes about other people in the city. It actually, when you have more exposure to nature, you're more likely to be generous to complete strangers. However, most New Yorkers, when I ask them about Central Park, say they haven't even been to your big, wonderful park in the last week. So you need to find ways, we all need to find ways to weave more nature into the nooks and crannies of our cities.
Now, when people are critical of cities, they often show those famous images of the destruction of the Pruitt, is it Igoe or Igoe?
Pruitt-Igoe.
A housing complex in St. Louis as what goes wrong with urban design and urban decay.
Well, there's a terrific film about this called The Pruitt-Igoe Myth, which suggests the common view of Pruitt-Igoe is actually false. That project was seen as a failure of public housing. What it, in fact, could instead be seen of as a failure to truly support residents in place and invest in those places. But I think if you look deeper, one lesson of Pruitt-Igoe is that, again, we all need the ability to control our relationships with the people around us. If we are pushed together too tightly, we tend to retreat. So if we can build places that create realms where we can have, say, smaller courtyard areas, where smaller groups of people can meet and share space, it's more effective.
Well, I guess that means doing better public housing in the future. But what do we do with all the housing stock we have now?
This is a very big question. Look,
I mean, New York has a lot of public housing, and much of it is has residents who would prefer to live elsewhere but have no choice in the matter.
Well, when we worked with the BMW Guggenheim Lab in the Lower East Side, and we talked to people expecting them to say horrible things about their public housing, instead what they said to us is, "Are you crazy? This is our last bastion. This is the only place many of us can live now. As the neighborhoods become gradually gentrified, we're being pushed out." So I would think maintaining the public housing you have is important, but also New Yorkers need to be more generous with each other in the public spaces they have. So the changes that have been happening in New York, in my opinion, have been remarkable. Taking street space, turning them into parks, plazas, and more people space is essential if you want to maintain well-being and social connections in the city.
Now, this is something that people knew in centuries ago. There was a study of Siena and its public plazas, which made people happy. But most cities do not have this. Portland decided to turn things around?
Well, I wouldn't say Portland more generally. Well, sure, Portland more generally. But I had a very powerful experience in Portland when I visited a couple of years ago. Some neighbors in one neighborhood of Portland felt, and this was a nice green neighborhood of detached homes. It was an inner suburb, fairly close to the city. And yet they still felt disconnected from each other. They still felt like there was no place to come together to connect with all the cars pouring through their neighborhoods. What they decided to do was to turn their own intersection into a piazza. So they marched out one Sunday and they started to paint this place up. Of course, no sooner had they painted their intersection than the city declared that it was a public space, therefore nobody has the right to use it. And they threatened to grind this piazza off. Well, eventually the neighbors prevailed. So not only did they create a pretty place, and it was nice to visit. It felt like, you know, that old American neighborhood where everybody knows your name. But in fact, when public health students actually studied these interventions, what they found was, because it caught on, you know, in neighborhood after neighborhood did their own intersection repair, as they called it. And what they found was that each intersection repair caused a blast radius of positive psychological well-being for blocks around. People slept better. They claimed to trust each other more. They knew their neighbors. There was less crime, less vandalism.
Haven't we seen something similar in Brooklyn? Some people in Brooklyn might be aware of a man named Aaron Neparstek. Can you talk about what he's done?
Well, Aaron is a funny guy. Aaron started his journey out as your typical angry New Yorker, as he explained it to me. The honking was incessant on his street. And he began by opening his window one morning when one horn honker would not stop. And he said, if I can get to my fridge and back to my window, and this guy is still honking, he's in for it. Well, the guy was still honking, and Aaron started chucking eggs out his window at this fellow. Well, the fellow spotted him and started screaming, you know, I'm coming back here and I'm going to kill you. And this is around the time of 9/11. So there was just a lot of angst in the air. And Aaron realized that this was not the right approach, and perhaps he needed to try a more gentle approach. So he started writing haikus about the nastiness of horn honking in the city and posting them on lampposts. But then after a while, he realized he needed to change the system around him. So he spent months pestering whoever it was at the city who controlled light signaling in the neighborhood. And he eventually got them to change the timing of light signals so that instead of everybody all the cars being piled up at his particular intersection, the waits were feathered. So people would be forced to stop at an intersection, but at a shorter time, at more intersections. What they found was that caused people to be less frustrated. They stopped honking their horns so much. But Aaron actually went on to help found a movement. We might call this the livable streets movement in New York City. The first thing they did is lobby to get rid of your previous Department of Transportation commissioner, which they did successfully. This led to the instatement of a new transportation commissioner, Janet Sadik Khan. And her department is populated with people from the livable streets movement. This was the dawn of a new area for streets in New York City.
We're pretty much out of time, but we have to talk about the city that is most in trouble in America, the city that's cited whenever people talk about what can happen to cities, Detroit. Mm. Can Detroit turn itself around?
Well, it's a tough question. It depends.
Because there have been projects to turn vacant lots into community farms, reclaim abandoned spaces, but the city still is not recovering from poverty, blight, crime, and filed for bankruptcy in July.
I think what we have to understand is the project to destroy a city can take decades, and that's what happened in Detroit with the flight from the city to deep sprawl, but also the efforts to rebuild a city can take decades as well. What we need to understand, though, is that our cities are malleable, they can change, and each one of us can help be part of that change.
Charles Montgomery's book is called Happy City, Transforming Our Lives Through Urban Design. It's published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.